Well, my name is Pat Mooney. I'm with the Accenture Group, which is an international civil society organization, and we're headquartered in Ottawa, Canada.
Mm-hmm. You were quite young when you started to deal with seeds. How did it start?
My first work internationally was really fundraising. Mm-hmm. Working with a bunch of different organizations trying to raise money for international development.
Yeah.
And I got tired of that after several years.
Yeah.
And so I took advantage of an opportunity and went backpacking around the world for about a year and a half. And when I was backpacking, I was in Sri Lanka. And I had volunteered with Oxfam to help out with some research they wanted done there.
Was that?
This was 1976.
Uh-huh.
And they had problems with malnutrition on the tea estates, which had just been nationalized. And while I was going in to do the evaluations of what was happening on the tea estates, which had to be done at night in darkness because the government wouldn't allow us in during the daylight, farmers that led us into the tea estates were complaining about the quality of their rice varieties and how poor they were. And I'd never thought about rice being diverse even.
Yeah.
Just, to me, it was just white stuff that I didn't particularly care for.
Yes.
And they told me that the old varieties had disappeared, they were forced to use these new varieties, I thought that just seemed so strange to me.
Yeah.
And a few months later, I was continuing my backpacking, I was at an UNCTAD conference in Nairobi. And met with some farmers there, one of whom told me that their wheat variety that they grew was also being grown in Canada, in my part of Canada.
Yeah.
Which I thought was impossible.
Yeah.
Because given the differences between Canadian climate and Kenyan climate.
Yeah.
When I was back in Canada a few months later, I actually checked almost immediately when I got back at our local library and found they were right.
Yeah.
There was a part of the genetic diversity of our major wheat variety in Canada included a Kenyan farmer variety.
Uh-huh.
So that just fascinated me. So I got involved in seeds because of that.
Yeah.
It was initially an educational thing to show to Canadians that, in fact, what we thought of ourselves as the breadbasket of the world, we were actually feeding from someone else's bowl, that we got all of our genetic diversity for our crops mm-hmm. from other people in other mm-hmm. parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That quickly got me to understand that the issue of the loss of genetic diversity in crops
yes.
was in part because of multinational companies moving in to buy the seed companies.
Yeah.
It was in part because of the link between seeds and pesticides being made and intellectual property rights being taken out on plant varieties.
Yeah.
So suddenly the issue, which I thought was basically an educational issue, a feel-good kind of issue about the world, and an environmental issue, only became a political issue and a corporate politics issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that led us into the United Nations and fights in the United Nations to try to get finally a seed treaty, which we've got now, and to try to get a commission on genetic resources to deal with these issues politically, which we have now,
mm-hmm.
and to have places like the Svalbard Global Seed Vault in Norway now as a backup station for endangered seeds and so on. So it's been a very long period of activity.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In the late 70s or early 80s, you published your first book.
That's right.
Yeah. What was the result of it?
It was called Seeds of the Earth in 79, and it was translated in Germany, actually, and in 1980 or 81.
Yeah.
And I was quite surprised that anyone paid any attention to it. But it did get some attention, and it was very encouraging that the biggest attention we got was from the multinational seed companies, who were really mad at us for writing it. And their anger about it all, in fact, in some ways got more media attention again. So it helped us to move on through the United Nations then to get this discussed as a political issue at the UN.
Yeah. Uh-huh. What did you do here, or what did you present here?
Well, we've moved on a long way since then. We continue to spend about half of our time dealing with seeds, probably.
Uh-huh.
But the other half of our time since the 90s has been involved in human genomics,
uh-huh.
looking at the patenting of human cell lines around the world, which we stumbled onto by accident. And then looking from that, but that's part of the new genomics research that's going on. We then, at the end of the 90s, began to look at nanotechnology and its implications for agriculture initially, but for everything in the South.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved on to look at synthetic biology, which is the extension of biotechnology, but a much more dangerous, much wider extension. And now we deal with geoengineering as well. So it's a wide field. We deal with all of the. We basically think of ourselves now as a technology watchdog that looks at all of the emerging technologies and tries to assess if they're good or useful or negative.
Okay, when you say we, you mean your NGO?
the Et Cetera Group, yes.
Okay.
We used to be known as RAFI. We just did agricultural work. When we expanded to dealing with all these other areas of technologies, we changed our name to Et Cetera Group.
Okay. Et Cetera Group.org.
Org, yes.
Yes, okay. I have no idea what problems can be caused by nanotechnology particles.
I'll give you a quick summary.
Please.
For nanotechnology, of course, the big thing about nanotechnology is that you build from the bottom up, and that you take advantage of quantum effects, so that instead of taking a tree and cutting it down to make a table, you actually build the table literally atom by atom
from the
first place.
Yeah.
But the quantum effects factor is also important because it means that instead of having simply the normal periodic table from which to build, you actually have a different periodic table every time you move down from 100 nanometers in size to 75 to 50 to 25 to 5. All of the characteristics of every element in the periodic table change. So for industry, it's like having a whole pile of new toys to play with from which to build things. And it fundamentally undercuts the nature of commodity markets as well, and the commodities that, of course, peasants and others are trying to produce around the world, miners and so on.
Yeah.
So it has profound implications for the economy of developing countries. Whether or not the technology itself is safe or good is one question, but certainly its disruptive effect on the economies of poor people is very clear.
Uh-huh.
So we addressed it really from the question of ownership and control of the technology, what would it mean for the poor?
Yeah.
We found since then that there are safety issues for sure, that nanoparticles can perform very differently. So gold nanoparticles, for example, I mean, gold that like I have in my wedding ring is very safe to use. That's why people use it and wear it all the time.
Yes.
When you get down to the nanoscale, this can be used as a catalyst for chemical reactions.
Yeah.
So it's very, very different, and that's true of everything else. So we've been concerned about the safety issues around that as well. We also look at synthetic biology, for example, which really is an extension of the seeds work in that But seeds moved into biotechnology when biotech companies began to buy out all the seed companies back in the 80s.
Mm.
And then we found that, in fact, many scientists were saying that biotechnology really wasn't very, very useful, which we agree with.
Yeah.
But they were saying that moving a gene from one species to another is very hazardous. You don't know how it's going to work. It's very expensive.
Yeah.
It's clumsy.
Yeah.
It's a sloppy technology.
Yeah.
So what they're proposing is to build DNA atom by atom. They can actually construct it themselves through the base pairs.
Okay.
And you can actually get gene... you can go to eBay, for example, now and buy a gene synthesizer for $400 secondhand, which will let you actually build your own DNA. It's very slow. If you want to make yourself a hamburger, lunch is going to be late.
Yes.
By about 4 billion years or so. But the faster ones, of course, the high-tech ones are much, much faster than that. So you actually can now build your own DNA, and scientists are now, as in the last year really, starting to build their own life forms even. So that transforms the nature of biomass, how biomass is going to be used, and we talk about a green economy. The issue then is, with these new synthetic biology technologies, who will own the biomass? Who will decide how we're going to construct life and what the life's going to be used for?
Yeah.
Mainly, what kind of microbes are we going to create to take the harvested material and turn it into plastics or fuels or food or fodder or who knows what? So that's been a major concern for us as well. And the biggest one we had to deal with is geoengineering, which is the idea that's becoming terribly popular, unfortunately, with some industrialized countries, which is that they recognize that they can't respond effectively to climate change.
Yes.
They can't politically do it. They don't think they can do it politically with their own populations.
Yeah.
They don't think industry will let them do it as well.
Yeah.
So the plan B for them is to say, don't worry, we have new technologies which will allow us to geoengineer the planet, to actually change the thermostat of the planet.
Have you an example how it works?
Tragically, yes, I do. and many of them, some of them have been developed here in Germany. Ocean fertilization, where you would take a large area of the surface of the ocean, you coat it where there's no nutrient, no iron nutrient base.
Yes.
You coat it with iron filings at the nanoscale. That iron filings then can be eaten up by bacterium, by phytoplankton. Phytoplankton then absorb carbon dioxide. The carbon dioxide with the phytoplankton sinks to the bottom of the ocean when they die, and so you sequester the carbon dioxide pulling it out of the atmosphere. That's the theory, and you've had the Alfred Wegener Institute here has been very actively involved in that research. The problem is there's been 13 tests done by governments around the world over the last 15 or 16 years. None of them have worked.
Yeah.
They all fail. But each time they fail, we get the scientists coming back to us saying, we need to have a bigger experiment.
Yes,
we need to take up more and more of the ocean to try again.
By the way, there is a quotation by Albert Einstein. if you try to improve a not running system by doing more of what it costs, yeah, it is a clear sign of craziness, yeah, of madness.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. So these guys are trying that, and that's an example of what's going on, and,
yeah,
and we've been opposing that. We got a moratorium established here in this very building, in fact, the hotel, in 2008,
yeah,
through the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. When they met here, 193 governments agreed that there should not be ocean fertilization, it shouldn't,
okay,
be allowed. But now they go on to say, okay, we can't do that, but there are ways in which we can modify the stratosphere. We can create artificial volcanoes to block,
yes,
sunlight.
Yeah.
And we put sulfates into the stratosphere at a high enough level, they'll float around for a long period of time,
mm-hmm,
lower temperatures, and that'll give us bias time to respond to climate change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's extraordinarily dangerous. You could,
yes,
you could change monsoon patterns, cause famines and droughts in different parts of the world, as well as health problems, of course, because what goes up comes down.
Yes, and some people think that, for example, this last tsunami of Japan and this East Asia may have been caused by, well, some experiments that went wrong, or maybe the earthquake in Haiti last year. Mm. There is this HAARP system in,
yeah,
Alaska. I have no idea what it really does.
I doubt it, frankly. I really doubt it. But I do know is that for sure is that governments are taking solar radiation management, the idea of putting dust into the stratosphere, seriously.
Mm-hmm.
The UK government just a few days ago, in fact, admitted that they are about to conduct an experiment in the next few weeks in which they will take a 1 kilometer high tube,
mm-hmm,
and blow salt water through it to see how well it works,
mm-hmm,
just to try it out with salt water.
Yeah.
But their goal and the funding is to actually create a 20 kilometer high tube, so it goes into the stratosphere, that would blow sulfates into the stratosphere and by the ton to try to lower again temperatures.
Yeah.
And that's a serious discussion that's going on with the UK, with the United States. The climate change negotiators are all talking about it now.
Yeah.
And we think that, again, as Albert Einstein would say, that's just crazy.
Yeah, yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to come back to seeds, because the biodiversity of the plants we use for nutrition and coloring and so on, clothes, I think I heard a number is now 25% of what it was 100 years ago or so, much less. What can every single listener do to help to save the seeds?
Well, they need to grow them. The best way to save seeds is we need to actually not just save seeds, we need to create diversity in seeds.
Yes.
Because we've lost a lot of it already. By some estimates, 75% of the genetic diversity of,
yeah,
our major food species has,
yeah,
already disappeared.
Yeah.
So we need to go back to that. And,
yeah.
And so everyone has got a patch of earth in their front yard or their backyard or their flower pots,
yeah,
or their rooftop needs to be growing food.
Yeah.
And they should be growing a variety of foods, a variety of species, and a variety of varieties within that, even.
Yeah.
So we have a lot there.
Uh-huh.
There's about 2.1 million varieties of seed in gene banks right now.
Yeah.
That's a relatively small percentage of what really does exist in nature.
Yeah.
So we need to get more of it, and we need to have, yeah, more of it being protected by
yes,
people who simply love seeds.
Yeah. Okay. Still, do you want to wish to transport some idea?
I think the...
What I didn't think of.
Yeah. No, I think those are the major areas. The for us, we used to, when I first got involved in this work, the big thing everyone talked about when I was doing work in Latin America was liberation theology. And they talked about how we have to have a theology of social change and social justice.
Yes.
I'm not a religious person, but I really like the idea that,
yeah,
we see that change has to come through principles and values,
yeah,
and they have to be negotiated in political forums for social goals.
Mm-hmm.
What we now have is not liberation theology, but liberation technology,
mm-hmm,
where every problem has a technological solution.
Yes.
Policymakers don't actually have to think anymore. They don't actually have to formulate policy. They simply say, we'll find a technological fix to take care of that for us. And that's simply dangerous and stupid, and it won't work. We need to go back to the fact that, yes, technologies have a role to play. Science has a role to play, but the foundation for justice and for solving our problems has to be social policies that we negotiate together.
Mm-hmm. So we need completely new paradigm to say how we see the world.
Yeah, we certainly need to have democracy.
Yes.
We should start with it. Yeah, we haven't had much of it in the world, and maybe it's time we did.
Yeah.
But we definitely have to have a democratic environment in which everyone gets involved in the discussion, and we don't shy away from dealing with the hard issues and the hard questions. And if some of them have technological solutions, that's fine.
Yeah.
But let's come to that as we need to. Technology is a tool. It's not a solution.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one new aspect is that we cannot leave the decisions to the scientists and the politicians, but now there's this new word of empowering everybody.
Yeah.
So everybody must know that everybody can contribute something.
Yeah, absolutely, that's critical. And no one's an expert on things that haven't been tried yet.
Yes.
And so when people talk about expertise in geoengineering or expertise in synthetic biology, there are none.
So
we all have something to say about it.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay.